judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Senior Airman Kyron L. Talley. In today's oral argument, we consider the following two issues. Whether the evidence in support of the specification of charge two is factually sufficient, and whether the government disproved mistake of fact as to consent is issue one. Issue two is whether the military judge erred by excluding evidence under military rule of evidence 412. Ladies and gentlemen, issue two will require me to close the court for oral argument. I will make that announcement after arguments have been heard on issue one. Counsel will have 15 minutes on each issue for arguments. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity to reserve time for rebuttal should they so choose. Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Mumford, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes,
Your Honor. Mr. Hockenberry, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal? Issue one.
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
Granted. As to issue two, do you choose to reserve?
3 minutes as well.
Granted. Very well, Mr. Hockenberry, you may proceed with your argument as to issue one.
Senior Judge Gruen, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Scott Hockenberry, along with Captain John Fredericks. We represent the appellant. This airman stands convicted on extraordinarily weak evidence. And simultaneously, as we'll discuss in more detail in the closed session, the military judge excluded evidence that would have further undermined the case against him. There was a total lack of corroborating evidence. There's no forensic evidence, no contemporaneous statements, prior consistent statements. There were no damaging admissions by appellant. There was no supporting expert testimony. There was no character evidence to support LP's truthfulness. For that matter, there were no other witnesses at all. The government only called two witnesses in its entire case in chief, the named victim and the special agent, and the special agent's only relevance to this charge was to introduce appellant statements where he maintained his innocence. All the government presented was about 5 pages of often vague, always uncorroborated testimony where LP leveled her accusations and then disclaimed memory of important details. So it's not a very strong foundation. And on top of that, there's powerful evidence about motive to fabricate or motive to exaggerate. LP only made her accusations after she became angry at appellant for other reasons, for leaving. And there was a delayed report that only was made after the motive to fabricate arose, and she explicitly acknowledged telling appellant after reporting him that she would stop getting him in trouble if he did what she wanted. It's troubling to see the military justice system co-opted, not for the purpose of justice, but as a tool for personal revenge and negotiating position. Prosecutions for sexual assault are cheapened when they are openly used as leverage. There's also a dynamic of sort of a race to the courthouse where LP says that appellant could just as easily had filed charges against her, which is record at 156. So there's weak evidence, and there's the motive to fabricate, and then there's also affirmative evidence of innocence in the form of appellant's statements to OSI. And appellant was extremely candid with OSI, not only in his statements, but he gave his phone, he gave his PIN number to his phone, and tens of thousands of pages of highly personal data. So this court should find appellant credible in his denials, but I do want to address, the government says a couple of times in his brief that we, the defense, are asking this court to find appellant's denials more credible than LP's accusations. But that framework, that would be more appropriate to something akin to a preponderance of the evidence standard, which of course is not the standard for a criminal conviction.
Counselor Hockenberry, Can I stop you right there? I wanted to go back to something you said about the record at 156, wherein evidence was sufficient to show that she might have been able to make a complaint. I mean, he might have been able to make a complaint against her had he gotten to the courthouse first. Can you elaborate on that point or discuss the evidence that shows her culpability or what you're relying on for that position?
That was a text. It was cross-examination of the named victim about a text message, which I believe was to her aunt, where she said he could just as easily have filed charges against me. So, you know, that was obviously not the main thrust of the evidence, but it was clear that there was a volatile relationship, and it was very clear that she had repeatedly assaulted appellant, including, well, we're not here to talk about the 128, but including during that offense.
Counsel, in order for us to do a factual sufficiency review, the new Article 66 requires that you make a specific showing of a deficiency in proof. Can you succinctly articulate for the court what your specific showing of a deficiency of proof is in this case?
Your Honor, I would point to six items, improbabilities in the accusations, the lack of corroboration, the delayed report that was only made after the motive to fabricate, the named victim's attempt to leverage her accusations into a desired outcome, appellant's credible denial, which constituted affirmative evidence of innocence, and the failure of the government to disprove mistake of fact as to consent. I've seen this argument in a lot of government briefs, that especially before this court, although the Army Court is seeing it more now too, but saying that almost in every factual sufficiency case, the government will say that the triggering mechanism has not been met, and often sort of without much elaboration. It's certainly true that the new Article 66 is a bit of a convoluted statute, and there's some ongoing appellate litigation about its scope, but this is not at all a borderline case in terms of the triggering mechanism. It's clearly met here.
Let me ask you this. If the case law establishes that minor inconsistencies between witness testimony is not sufficient as a triggering mechanism, isn't that exactly what we have here? You've got the appellant's position, and then you have the testimony from LP. So with that being said, how do you fall outside of you've got inconsistencies in what the witnesses say or what the two individuals involved say about the situation that forms the basis of the charged offenses with which the appellant stands convicted?
Well, Your Honor, I think certainly one witness saying that the assault happened and one saying it did not happen would constitute a specific deficiency. I think there's an unpublished case that talks about minor inconsistencies within, internal inconsistencies within a victim's testimony, not triggering factual sufficiency review. And I think that was in isolation. So there's also synergy between these factors. But I don't know of any case that would say a witness or in this case a recorded statement saying the accusations were untrue would not constitute a specific showing of a deficiency in proof.
Do you have a proposed test or definition of what a sufficient, specific showing of a deficiency in proof is that this court would use to determine if you've made it in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I've never had a CCA refuse to conduct a factual sufficiency review, and the government makes this argument in every case. So I guess I'm not too worried about reaching factual sufficiency here. In terms of the test, I think the intent of the new Article 66 is to relieve this court of the burden of conducting factual sufficiency review in every case by requiring the issue to be raised by appellants. So I would think the showing would be quite low, but I'm beginning to think the new Article 66 is not a great example of legislative drafting. But it's I'm confused by the language because it seems like how could you have a conviction that would be factually sufficient factually insufficient, but not trigger factual sufficiency review. Government arguments sometimes make it seem like the triggering mechanism is a higher standard than actually finding factual insufficiency. So I guess I don't have a good succinct definition, but I'm sure that it is. I mean, this is not a borderline case at all in that regard. And I don't know of any of the precedent cited by the government or otherwise that would suggest that this court should not conduct factual sufficiency on anything like the facts here.
So, counsel, assuming the triggers are met for Article 66 review, you've cited a half a dozen or so categories or specific deficiencies. So do we apply the same level of deference to all six categories because it's a military judge alone case and a military judge would typically be granted more deference? Or do we have differing levels of deference throughout the six categories?
Your Honor, I don't think that a military judge, the level of deference this court applies to factual sufficiency is different based on the forum. There's no different test for factual sufficiency because it's a military judge alone case. There is Article 66, is language about appropriate deference as explained by Caff and Harvey. I think that would differ based on the nature of the evidence, which in this case you have two pieces of evidence. You have the witness testimony, which would tend to be higher deference, and you have the videotape denial, which this court can review the video as well as the trial court, so I would say that would be lower deference. But the deference is based on the nature of the evidence. I find the new language, the language in the new Article 66 about deference to be very similar to the language in the old Article 66, which required this court to recognize that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. But I don't think the fact that it was a military judge alone impacts it at all.
Counsel, I want to talk about mistake of fact as the consent. Because this was a military judge alone forum, there was no discussion about instructions or indication from the parties what instructions would be requested. So what evidence in the record is there to indicate, first, that the defense was raised at trial, and second, that the military judge considered that defense?
Right. There was no special findings either, which would have oriented that. I would have liked to see a request for special findings, but I think it clearly was on the table and raised by the very low bar required to put it in issue by appellant's statement alone, but also by LP's descriptions, inconsistencies in her descriptions and ambiguities in her descriptions about her request to stop, appellant's responses. She says she doesn't remember all of his verbal responses. And also the timing. There was a lot of ambiguity about, the only reason consent was withdrawn was discomfort. There's a lot of ambiguity about appellant's attempt to resolve that discomfort with changing positioning or the pillow or whatnot. So I think it was clearly raised here. It's a very low standard to raise it.
Does it matter that appellant's counsel at the trial level didn't discuss that defense in its closing argument?
No, Your Honor, I think that there's no requirement to discuss it, and of course there was no like waiver because there's no instructions. Seeing my time has expired, Your Honor.
If you want to finish the answer, please feel free.
Right, I don't think there's a requirement to, I mean, the defense doesn't have to give any particular closing argument to raise a defense. The government's burden applies equally to the elements and also to affirmative defenses raised by the evidence, and mistake of fact was clearly raised.
Anything additional, Judge Morgan? Thank you very much, Mr. Hockenberry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Mumford, you may proceed with your argument as to issue one.
Senior Judge Gruen, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Catherine Mumford, and together with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Bent over, pregnant, and in pain, LP asked her husband to stop penetrating her vulva with his penis 3 to 5 times, at which point he suggested she put a pillow under her stomach. She declined and reasserted that she was not consenting to the penetration as it was happening. And for 10 minutes, he kept penetrating her while she begged him to stop. His conviction for sexual assault without consent is factually sufficient, and it is supported by the weight of the evidence for 2 reasons. Number 1, LP was a credible witness who proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And number 2, because mistake of fact as to consent was not reasonably raised by the evidence. And to the extent it was disproven. First, going to LP's testimony. She was a credible witness who established all of the necessary elements for the offense under charge 2. She testified to several details regarding this incident. She testified that it began as a consensual encounter and that she began to experience pain upon the 5th thrust or stroke of appellant's penis into her vagina, at which point she began telling him to stop. She testified that she asked him 3 to 5 times. She testified that he suggested she put a pillow in that she refused, and that that assault continued for 10 minutes as she continuously told him, "No, stop, you're hurting me, you're hurting the baby. You're being too rough." Under the Rodriguez-Rivera standard, Your Honor, 1 credible witness is enough to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt, and that was the case here. Beyond a reasonable doubt is not evidence which is free from any conflict. The government's burden is not that which is to prove a case to a mathematical certainty, and the government's burden certainly is not to present evidence which is free from conflict, but rather evidence that left the fact finder firmly convinced. And in this case, the fact finder found her credible and was firmly convinced as to appellant's guilt.
Counsel, does the government concede that the sufficient trigger for factual sufficiency review was established in this case?
For the Article 66 trigger, Your Honor? No, we do not concede that, Your Honor. I think, well, first of all, one of the issues raised was a simple corroboration, that there was no corroboration of the evidence. Because of Rodriguez-Rivera, that cannot be a specific deficiency because it is established that 1 credible witness is enough. Regarding the other aspects, I think it's present that there is some kind of issues with the facts that appellant has raised. However, this court should hold appellants to a higher standard to meet that burden that's a specific showing. Elsewhere in the MCM, Congress has given language of different types of showing, a colorable showing, a substantial preliminary showing, but here Congress has directed a specific showing, which denotes something which is precise, something which is clear. In appellant's brief, it's not clear whether these complaints are raised to go to an element or elements, or whether it's simply complaining about LP's credibility in general, or whether it goes to their centrality of, you know, she made the whole thing up, or that it happened but it was consensual. It's not clear. There are inferences to be made, and to the extent that this court finds that that trigger has been met, this court should move on to the factual sufficiency review as a whole and find that this case is factually sufficient.
So I want to stop you there and ask you a question with respect to the factual sufficiency of the evidence. You are arguing that she was in, that LP was entirely credible. How does that square with the pretty consistent denials of appellant through the OSA interviews that were admitted as evidence? Is it the government's position that this court should apply less deference to that evidence that was presented at the trial?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, so it would be less deference for the OSI interview that is contained on the disc. However, it should be high deference given to the fact finder who was able to see LP testify and to make a full credibility assessment that is those nonverbal cues and things like that, which are not present in the record for this court's review.
And when you talk about the government's brief talked about corroboration and used a statement about the birthday sex assault, alleging or stating with assurance that the snippet from appellant's OSI interview discussing when he was asked about sex on his birthday and whether or not he remembered it, Your position, if I read it right, is that it was, that's corroboration. You can believe her because he's corroborated what she's saying about the birthday sex. But the way I remember his statement was that he came around to saying, could happen, I don't know. It was completely remarkable to him. Do you consider that piece of information to be corroboration for the government's position about the credibility or the corroboration of LP's testimony at trial?
So, two things, Your Honor. First, it can be considered corroboration. In his OSI interview, he remarked that he was confident or had some positive affirmation that they probably did have sex because it was his birthday, but he didn't recall the incident at all. And as a second matter, Your Honor, for him, it may have just been his birthday, but for her, it was sexual assault. And for her, she remembered those details because it was a traumatic event for her. As we're delving into some of LP's credibility, something I would we would ask the court to consider is that LP did testify to facts that were not in her favor. Now, appellant would put that forward as something that cuts against her credibility, but Your Honor, it supports her credibility. It shows and demonstrates that she wasn't there to make herself look good. She wasn't there to walk back any of the mistakes that she felt she made. She was there to tell the truth.
And which facts are you relying on that were not in her favor?
Facts that she talked about were immediately after the sexual assault stopped, that she blamed herself, she felt bad, she apologized, she immediately began consenting or began another sexual act with him and was completely consenting just moments after the sexual assault happened. She testified, she talked about her conflicting feelings. She talked about going and talking to law enforcement and why it was delayed reporting. And she specifically clarified that she went to law enforcement completely separate and apart from any divorce proceedings that were going on. She talked about how she had these conflicting feelings because of the cycles of violence and abuse and then reconciliation that she went through in her marriage. She didn't try to make herself look like some damsel in distress. She wasn't exaggerating or minimizing any of her actions or appellant's actions. She testified truthfully. And that testimony didn't come out through other witnesses because she wasn't willing to admit it. She freely and openly admitted to the mistakes and some of the things that she did that were not in her favor. That supports her credibility, Your Honor.
Do you think the fact that she was attempting at trial to show that she maybe engaged in the post what she considered assault, continued sex, maybe that her testimony was attempting to validate why she might do that as opposed to being a testimony to her detriment that proves up her credibility? I mean, are there two sides to the coin that you're arguing? Valid sides.
I think, Your Honor, again, to my first point, she was there to tell the truth, and she did tell the truth. And to the second point, Your Honor, a reasonable fact finder, based on all the evidence, can see how she was in a position where as soon as the sexual assault stopped, she forgave him, and she blamed herself, and she apologized, and she felt bad, and it was his birthday. And so they engaged in consensual sex following that. She testified as to her motivations at times of wanting to save the marriage and reconcile, and then other times where she did not want to reconcile the relationship because she didn't want to continue in this relationship.
So, counsel, I'd like to return to the Article 66 triggers.
Yes, Your Honor.
And understanding that we've bifurcated issues one and two, so please, you know, confining your answer to issue one. The trial defense counsel argued mistake of fact at page 38 of the record of trial. The rulings all addressing 412 and the briefs lay out the mistake of fact legal standard. And I believe at least one paragraph in the 412 motion argues the evidence is offered for a reasonable mistake of fact. So, and we have cases holding that the government's failure to overcome a mistake of fact is a specific deficiency. So, is it the government's position that mistake of fact was not raised?
at least to the point to trigger 66 review?
To the first part of your question, Your Honor, reasonable mistake of fact may be a specific deficiency where appellant can point to specific points in the record in evidence that was presented and admitted at trial and tie that to an argument or an explanation on balance why it impeaches or contradicts the verdict. So that's my first point. My second point would be that there was pretrial there was discussion raising the mistake of fact, and I won't go into any specific language regarding in the 412 ruling because we're in an open session right now, but that it was raised or flagged as a potential avenue for the defense pretrial. However, when the evidence came out, that defense was not reasonably raised by the evidence. And to the extent it was certainly disproven, and it was addressed by government counsel during their closing argument.
So if government argued mistake of fact in their findings argument, is that some indication that it was raised?
I think the government trial counsel was covering all their bases within their burden to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And knowing that it was raised pretrial, I think they addressed that issue perhaps out of an abundance of caution. I don't think, Your Honor, it's a concession that it was reasonably raised, especially when it's a military judge alone case. We don't have those conversations about what instructions would have been given had it been with members.
Can you specifically articulate which prong or your argument for why the defense was not reasonably raised at trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Neither prong was met. It was not reasonably raised by the evidence. We know that the defense didn't argue it in closing, even though they had previously raised it, and it's a reasonable inference to say that they didn't raise it or talk about it because they knew after LP had testified that it was not reasonably raised by the evidence. There was no evidence indicating that at that time, in that moment, on October 3rd, that appellant had any thought in his mind, subjective, honest belief that she was consenting, which is the first prong that's the subjective prong.
What about the government's theory of the case that that as they started their opening statement, it's not rape because you're my wife. So this idea that he had in his mind and that he had communicated to his wife and they had discussed together some sort of agreement between them about what sex looks like in their marriage. And the government elicited evidence from LP during her testimony about this discussion, both before their marriage and during their marriage, that the accused and she had an understanding about what sex looked like. Is that not evidence of an honest and reasonable mistake of fact?
No, Your Honor, because we don't know that he held it in that moment. We don't know if it was a joke between them. We don't know if it was an honest belief that he held in that bed on that date.
So, counsel, there's a difference between some evidence that a trier of fact could attach that argument to you, and the things that we don't know at trial would be things the government would have to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. So can you bifurcate your argument as to why that's not evidence of it, rather than not a good argument, but not evidence of it, if that question makes sense?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think it's the honesty portion and also the timeliness portion. It may have been something that was in his mind at some point during the marriage at some point, but there's no evidence that in that bed on that night he had that thought in his head or that it was something that he ascribed to more than simply a joke. And to the extent that this court finds that this defense was raised and perhaps that there is some evidence that he did hold this belief, the second prong under the reasonableness or the objective standard, prong two of mistake of fact, was certainly overcome at trial. It cannot be that a reasonable, prudent, sober adult could be penetrating somebody while they begged them to stop. No, stop, you're hurting me, you're being too rough, you're hurting the baby, is somehow reasonably mistaken to be this person is consenting to how I'm penetrating them in this way.
So, counsel, understanding your time is about to expire, you may complete your answer to my following question, which is the same question I posited to appellant's counsel. Appellant having cited a half a dozen categories of specific deficiencies with respect to the level of deference that we would afford each category, at least one of the categories was the absence of evidence, the absence of character evidence as to LP's truthfulness, no contemporaneous statements, no forensics, to cite a few. So are we required to give the absence of evidence any deference at all, should we deem that evidence important?
No, Your Honor, because of the Rodriguez-Rivera standard, where one credible witness who the fact finder finds credible and who establishes all the facts and elements necessary for the offense is sufficient to meet a case beyond a reasonable doubt.
So you would take issue with appellant's counsel's position that we would apply varying levels of deference to the categories?
So the amount of deference due to the fact finder is high deference, especially when we're talking about evidence which is presented. However, to the extent that there may be gaps or what appellant has alleged are gaps in the evidence, or what he is alleging is missing, things like forensics, things like character evidence, those are not necessary to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. And this court should not give deference to the fact that unnecessary evidence is missing.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Yes, thank you. I just want to go back to mistake of fact as the consent and the reasonableness prong, and this discussion between appellant and LP throughout their relationship about what sex looked like, what her duty was as a wife. And understanding that two consenting adults can agree during consensual sex to a variety of things that may be objectively unreasonable, but between the two individuals, for example, within the sexual relationship, no means yes, or some use of physical force that is agreed upon, right? So to what extent does this court look at the agreement between two consenting adults versus this objectively reasonable standard in the lens of mistake of fact as a consent?
So, Your Honor, the objectiveness prong is a reasonable person prong. It's somebody, it includes the all known facts known by appellant at that time. There's no indication in the record that LP agreed with or adopted or disregarded her own consent in favor of her husband. She testified that he had said this thing many times, which made her feel that it was her duty as a wife to submit. Despite the fact that he had told her that several times, through her actions, she demonstrated that she did not consent and she wanted it to stop. And she told him that several times, to the point where she became in so much pain that she began to cry, at which point he finally did stop.
Anything additional, Judge Morgan? Thank you, Captain Mumford.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hockenberry, you may proceed with rebuttal pertaining to issue one.
Thank you, Your Honor. The list of evidence that was not presented here, if I could zero in on one, the lack of expert testimony. The government seems to be asking this court, to some extent here at oral argument, but much more fulsomely in the briefings, to consider these expert-like considerations, counterintuitive behavior, specialized knowledge. I hope this court will address in its opinion to what extent, if any, this court can draw on specialized knowledge like that, expert-like knowledge, when an expert was not called at trial. This court's review is limited to the record. If the government can not call an expert, but then just make the same arguments on appeal, we would submit, of course, that that's not proper. But this court, I think, is an interesting issue, and I hope this court will address it in its opinion.
Mr. Huckenberry, let me ask you this. Do you think there's any level of common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world of the layman that would give some deference to considering this seemingly expert term of the counterintuitive victim?
I think there's some, but I also think that the arguments the government makes in its brief go far beyond common knowledge. And they're really just surrogate expert testimony. And the government was free to call an expert here. It would have been a really ideal case to call an expert. Remember, we used to do a lot of judge-alone trials. Small circuit, it's always the same judge. And we would call the same expert to give the same testimony. But we couldn't just say, remember the expert testimony from the trial last week. You have to actually present it on the record. And with respect to the case law about corroboration not being essential, I think the government misstates it or overstates it to some extent when by saying that one witness equals sufficient evidence. It's not that one witness means a case is per se factually sufficient. It's just that the fact that there is only one witness is not fatal to a case. It's not dispositive. So you can't per se overturn a conviction because there's only one witness. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But that certainly cuts against the government. If there's a conviction that was had on less evidence or weaker evidence, it's obviously more likely to be factually insufficient. And this case is on the very extreme end of that sliding scale. Pending Your Honor's questions.
A follow-on question to that. In your reply brief, at page 7, you make the point that the government objects that these are not inherent improbabilities, but rather counterintuitive victim behavior. This is simply a different description of the same thing. So I just want to be sure I'm following your argument. Are they the same thing? Or is expert-like counterintuitive behavior something different?
Your Honor, I think it's improbable that, for example, I think it's not, you don't need to be an expert to know that this behavior is improbable. The government could try to counter it with an expert to say, to explain it away. But if they want to do that, they actually have to call an expert. I don't think the defense needs to call an expert to say, this doesn't add up. The defense doesn't need an expert on intuitive victim behavior. But if the government wants to argue counterintuitive victim behavior, there needs to be a basis for that in the record.
So this is an argument that is attributable to appellate counsel as opposed to the trial level. Is that part of your point?
I think my point is that the government is making arguments on appeal that are not established by any facts in the record or any evidence, which really the only evidence that could establish this sort of specialized considerations would be expert testimony.
Thank you, counsel.
No. Thank you, Mr. Huckenberry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, I must ask that individuals who are not specifically permitted to remain in this closed hearing session per its 20 January 2026 order to please depart the courtroom.